Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio.
I watched this movie last night, Casey.
Oh, you watched it last night?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I had never seen it before.
Right.
And the only Godard picture I've seen was
Breathless? Or
Breathless,
yeah.
Of course, which I loved. I think that's the only thing I've seen.
You never know. You might have seen another one because he's made so many. But you'd probably remember it if you did.
Like top.
My Life to Live.
Nope.
Pierre Le Fou.
Nope.
Weekend.
No.
All right.
I think
I'll stop there.
I thought this is a really interesting film, though.
Yeah.
Not what I expected.
What were you expecting? Were you expecting it to be like more kind of experimental?
I don't know. I don't think so, because this was pretty experimental.
It is, but
in a lot of ways.
By Godard's standards, I think it's kind of his most straightforward movie that he made.
Well, which is hysterical to
yeah.
think about.
Yeah, because He was working for the only time in his career with like American money,
right?
And it was like a French American Italian co-production,
yeah,
which was super common in that era. There was this whole like thing happening where movies were being made internationally with money from a bunch of different countries,
right?
And oftentimes they would stipulate that if you're gonna get money from all these places, we need you to have like stars who come from all these places,
yeah.
or include
shoot
like
in
some of the
language,
you know, yeah, the locations, yeah. the language used, and, yeah. and all the rest of it. So
you get that sense in this. I did a little bit of reading on it and did see where like there was a lot of contention, like as far as forcing him to do certain things, like
yes.
shoot in CinemaScope, which he didn't want to do.
Which is, I read that too, and that was weird to me because he uses CinemaScope a lot, actually, in the 60s.
Post this film?
Yeah, I think this might be his first. No, that's not right, because he made, like, A Woman is a Woman comes before this. He sort of, when he's going to shoot in color, he'll shoot CinemaScope, and when he's going to shoot in black and white, that's when he'll shoot Academy, like 4x3.
Right.
And nowadays, all he does is, like, 16x9. But, you know, for a very long time.
Is he still alive and making movies?
Yeah, he's 89, or he will be 89 in December.
Wow.
And yeah, he had a film out, I think it was earlier this year that I saw
had
it in
no
Atlanta,
idea.
But it played last year, I want to say. Yeah, it was last year that it played in Cannes. But
what was the name?
This one was called The Image Book.
Is it good?
Yeah,
is he still
I mean,
making good movies?
Yeah, well, here's the thing. I mean, this is the whole like rabbit hole to go down, but his films of the 60s are kind of, that's one era. That's like one period of his filmmaking.
Sure.
And he doesn't really, around like 1968, after May 1968 in France, which was where there's this large student movement against the government and workers got involved. There were big strikes and so on. And it kind of looked for a minute like there might be like a revolution in France. And Godard became like very politicized in that period.
Uh-huh.
He was part of a group that basically shut down the Cannes Film Festival that year. And just said, why are we showing movies? We should be out in the streets, you know?
Right.
And after that, he became rapidly like disillusioned with commercial filmmaking, which is funny because if you watch his earlier stuff, he already seems like he's highly critical of the Hollywood system
yeah,
and so
on. Yeah,
I mean,
is he sort of the French Altman in some ways?
Maybe so, yeah. Yeah, in terms of like wanting to be independent, wanting to kind of buck the system.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. They like the French in general, like that group that Godard is from, the Cahiers du Cinéma group.
Mm-hmm.
Cahiers du Cinéma was like, or still is, kind of one of the main film magazines in France.
Yeah.
And there's a whole generation of critics who were writing for Cahiers du Cinéma under André Bazin, who's like a real important film theorist.
Uh-huh.
But it's people like Godard, François Truffaut, Eric Rohmer,
right.
Claude Chabrol, Alain René, et cetera, who were critics who just wrote about films, and then they all started making films. And that was the new wave, the French
right.
new wave, the Nouvelle Vague. And so where was I going with that? What was the point of that tangent? Just Godard
yeah.
being an independent. So they had a real love-hate relationship to the American cinema because they loved a lot of classical Hollywood cinema They loved, you know, John Ford, for instance.
Yeah. Well, and there are a lot of mentions in this film.
Yes, yeah.
About, you know, Rio Bravo.
Exactly.
And the posters on the Psycho was on the wall of the Italian studio.
Right. Yeah. So, Godard always plays with that kind of intertextuality where he's making all these references to other films. And he doesn't do so many in this movie. That's another reason why I think it's a little more conventional, that it's not such a – like it is a film about film. It's a film about cinema. But it's also like it is telling more of a straightforward story than most of his films, which are apt to just kind of break away from the main narrative and go off on tangents much more.
Yeah. I saw the when I was reading about the CinemaScope thing that he had a problem with it, that some people say that that accounts for a lot of those kind of really unusual shots where he would say like, all right, you want a super wide frame? Then I'm going to throw a dolly and just ping pong it back and forth during a conversation.
Yeah, at the table where it's going past the lamp.
Yeah, and, it's kind of cool though. I mean, it's like why put the people in the frame if you can be a little more playful with it?
And it emphasizes their separation, of course, the distance between them, which is something that over and over visually he's playing with, where Brigitte Bardot and Michel Piccoli are on like extreme opposite ends of the frame.
Right.
Almost where they're like cut off at the edge of the frame sometimes.
He plays with space a lot in this movie.
That apartment sequence in the middle.
Yeah. Well, let's hold
we'll hold off on that. But
it opens with and the other thing too I wanted to mention, which segues nicely into the opening of the film, is the I also read that he was basically forced to do a nude shot.
That's why that sequence is there.
Of, you know, the most beautiful woman in all of cinema, which was Brigitte Bardot.
Right, right.
Which, hard to argue.
Yeah.
And so he does this opening shot of her laying there with her naked butt up.
Yep.
Completely insecure, just asking about every single body part, how if it's okay with her husband.
Yeah, and I feel like
completely desexualizes.
Yeah.
Clearly thumbing his nose at the studio, like, all right, you want her naked?
Yes.
Here it is.
Exactly, yes.
The least arousing sexual thing you could imagine.
Yeah, to really kind of just, like, completely circumvent that whole vibe. And, yeah, almost a commentary on objectification because she is objectifying herself by saying, do you like my feet? Do you like my ankles?
Right.
Do you like my legs? Do you like my thighs?
My shoulders, I think they're too round.
Yeah, yeah.
But it also, it's not just a fuck you, like it plays in the film, because so much about this movie has to do with the back and forth power struggle.
Yeah.
Not even struggle, just who has the power in any fucking given minute in their relationship.
The way it shifts constantly between
constantly.
Them.
Constantly. I'd never seen anything like it.
Yeah.
It was a little like disorienting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of like arguments or disputes I've been in where it's like you say one wrong thing and then it's kind of like it just you keep digging when you're trying. You should just shut up at that point.
Right.
But you can't. You can't leave it alone.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So like a small thing turns into a way bigger thing.
Oh, sure. And not that he was any prize.
No.
I mean, he hits her.
Yeah.
He flirts and like
touches
the other lady.
He's kind of a jerk.
But he is also kind of like, what happened?
Mm-hmm.
We woke up, everything was fine.
Exactly, yeah. It's just the suddenness with which it happens that
I think
it kind of like, you know, he can't quite wrap his head around how quickly it turned.
Yeah, but what is clear and what you'd never see and what you can only surmise as a viewer is it did not suddenly happen.
Yeah, sure.
And this is something that had been happening for a long time.
Exactly.
And he was probably wrapped up in his career or his own self or whatever. It's the early 60s and, you know, women didn't have as much agency in a marriage. So that's probably all been happening.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of like a straw that broke the camel's back kind of thing.
It feels that way.
Yeah.
But I love that you're left to sort of put that together.
Yeah.
I mean, Godard doesn't hand you anything.
No, certainly not. And I mean, he's giving a lot in this film because he's working from this novel that had a lot more kind of psychology, let's say, of the characters kind of baked into it.
Okay.
Because typically in one of his films, it's something, especially in the 60s, that he plays around a lot, just people changing their minds suddenly or doing things where the motivation is completely obscure, like you don't know why.
Yeah, I noticed that. And it's – if you've never seen a movie like this or a Godard film, like it's challenging, but not in a it's artsy fartsy, but not in a way that feels like someone's just trying to be artsy fartsy.
Right.
Does that make sense?
It's just his way of being. It's just how he thinks, how he kind of like looks at the world. And he's somebody that just his mind is working like a mile a minute. Like there's so much going on.
Yeah.
all the kind of intellectual, philosophical sort of like notions that are flowing into things at all times, mm-hmm. and the multiple levels of reference and the film within the film and,
yeah.
you know, casting like Fritz Lang as himself basically, but he's kind of like a different Fritz Lang in the movie, even yeah. though he has made like M and, you know, he sure. references his own actual films, but like the film that he's making does not feel at all like a real Fritz Lang film.
Right. Well, and in the film he's being forced to make, I mean, that's kind of one of
yeah,
the big struggles.
He's been compromised.
He wants to make the real Odyssey
yeah.
from Homer.
Yeah.
And Jack Palance as what's his name?
Prokosh, Jeremy Prokosh.
Yeah, he's trying to make a kind of a schlocky
yeah,
Hercules
exactly.
and the Argonauts type of thing.
Right. And one of the producers on the real film, this guy Levine, he had made a Hercules film.
Oh, really?
And
so was it a jab?
Yeah, yeah, it was kind of a jab. And it's so interesting that like he's one of the producers and you're kind of making a film against him,
right.
you know, in
yeah.
a way, in sort of an obscure way, but still like...
He is the French Altman.
Yeah, 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 yeah. I did want to say one more thing about that opening sequence, the scene in the bed with mm-hmm. the nude scene, the color filters that are placed over that scene.
Yeah, very unusual looking.
Starts out red,
uh-huh.
then shifts to white, and
yeah.
then shifts to blue. So it's like the colors of the American flag. Again, he's sort of saying like, hey, this is Hollywood. It's kind of forcing
yeah.
me to do this.
Well, and the way he used color through all of it yeah. was amazing.
Yeah, it's one of his best-looking films of
yeah.
that era, for sure.
Oh, all that mid-century furniture was just making me crazy.
And the shots of the Mediterranean, just like the
yeah,
way it's like endless
blue.
Sea. Yeah.
And just the so primary with the coloring, like the very
reds.
red
yeah.
robe, the very yellow robe.
Yeah.
That those great sofas. I was going crazy for the furniture.
Yeah,
in the screening room that were
yes.
two tone.
Yeah,
it's like burnt orange and blue.
Yeah.
Oh God, it was great.
That screening room. It's not translated, but underneath the screen,
mm-hmm.
there's a quote from one of the Lumiere brothers, who are you know one of the like inventors of cinema, basically.
Yeah.
There's a quote that says the cinema is an invention without a future.
Oh, interesting.
Which is such a funny thing to have in like a screening room, you know?
Yeah, there was a lot of little, I think, clever little winks
yeah.
throughout the film. It's interesting, too, when you say they didn't translate that, but character-wise, the translator,
yes.
who was Jack Palance's, I guess, assistant slash girlfriend.
Yeah,
slash,
Francesca.
Yeah, translator.
Yeah, right.
It was interesting to see what she chose to translate and what she did not choose to translate
Absolutely.
At all and how she chose to translate throughout the film.
Yeah.
Very... purposeful.
Yeah, it can be a little maybe even grating at times because it feels like every line of dialogue you have to hear it twice. But it's fascinating because
yeah.
it really forces you to like pay attention
uh-huh.
to what's being said in a way that Godard really does not do very often
yeah.
to like emphasize things or to have that kind of slight differences in meaning. I mean, he plays with language a ton. And he always has double entendres and obscure references to things. But just the way it's done here to more of like a dramatic,
mm-hmm.
character-driven effect is really interesting.
Yeah. Let's go back to that first – not the first shot because that's the nude thing. But then it goes to our story.
Mm-hmm.
And the very first thing you see I thought was so cool. It was the dolly shot. But – not what we're used to seeing.
Yeah.
It was almost a reverse of that.
Yeah.
We're used to the camera on a dolly taking us to a thing
yeah.
or a person. And in this case, we are stationary and the camera is coming to us.
Yeah.
And to the point where at the very end of that shot, they tilt down.
And point right at
point the right at
the viewer. Another camera that we have
yeah.
kind of like not even – it's sort of like you don't realize there's a second
yeah.
camera there, but of
you
course
forget
there is.
For a second.
Yeah. Yeah.
That what you're, you feel like almost you're there.
Yeah.
And if you step back – on the set and you think about the two cameras like staring
yeah.
at each other.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's really yeah. kind of a cool thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very interesting shot. I love that the credits are just read like verbally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course, we see it as text because there's subtitles, but
yeah.
You know, if it was a French audience, you would just be hearing the names of the people
yeah.
and the kind of like laid back ways like so-and-so did the sound.
Sure.
Raoul Cotard did the photography, you know. Based on a novel by this guy.
Yeah. The other cool thing, though, is when I see that, I mean, film equipment has changed and technology has changed, to be sure, but so much is also the exact same. So the dolly and the
yeah,
technology
sure.
is the same
that
thing.
That has not changed, yeah.
And the camera, when he's spinning
the geared head.
Yeah, the gear heads. Yeah. It's like it's still all the same stuff.
Yeah.
It's so cool to see something from the early 60s that you will find still on the set up. Today.
Yeah.
Because the dolly is perfect.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean,
it's a big, heavy sled with wheels on a track.
There's been, you know, a lot of technical innovations in that, but there's still no substitute for, like, just a legit dolly.
For sure.
Like, some grips to push it and some track. And
that's right.
There's just nothing else like it in cinema.
People power.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So then we get our setup, which I never realized. And in fact, there were quite a few things that I noticed that I was like, oh, that movie totally stole from this.
Oh, sure.
And I don't know. I looked up a few of them to see if I could find the link, and I didn't see anyone mention Barton Fink.
Interesting. Yeah. But I'll show you the left of the mind, the whole like idea
the whole
of the writer.
Was, bringing a playwright to write this Hollywood script.
Give him some of that Barton Fink feeling.
He's totally fish out of water and doesn't know what to do and
Absolutely.
Has an internal struggle about whether or not to do this.
Yeah.
And that's sort of where it leaves it, and Barton Fink becomes different. But I don't know if the seed of that film for the Coens came from
this. I mean, I know the Coens were thinking about real-life instances, like I think Faulkner.
Uh-huh.
You know,
sure.
There's a character in Fink who's kind of like based on that.
And it was when they had writer's block working on which one? Was it Miller's Crossing?
Miller's Crossing, yeah.
That they'd knocked out Barton Fink.
Yeah.
But that initial seed was too similar to not have gotten, you know, some sort of inspiration, I think.
Yeah, and just the idea, the larger theme of like prostitution is like a big thing that recurs in a lot of Godard's films. And it's not just what we traditionally think of as prostitution,
it's
like
not
selling sex.
Work, sure.
It's, you know, selling any part of yourself that, you know, selling your labor, selling your time,
devaluing
selling
yourself.
creativity even. Yeah. That's what the Michel Piccoli character feels like. He's like, I'm supposed to be a playwright, you know, I'm supposed to be doing the stuff that like capital M matters, you know, and now they've got me out in Hollywood and I'm doing these things for the money and the pay is great. And, you know, it allows him to have
pay
like a lifestyle, pay off the apartment, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he feels restless. And,
that's his first film too, right? I read that.
Who, Michel Piccoli?
That's what it said. And
I don't know about that.
I think
I'd be
in the
amazed
Roger
if it
Ebert
is.
Article I read, so that was his first.
I would be shocked, but perhaps so.
What else has he been in?
Well, he's in a lot of films from that era.
Italian films, I suppose. Or?
Yeah, Italian films, French films, and he's actually still around today
really?
As well. Yeah,
he was great, man.
Yeah, no, I love Michel Piccoli.
Wearing the hat in the bathtub, he never took it off.
Yeah, the Dean Martin
Some
Came Running
like
reference. Yeah, yeah.
So that's our initial setup. Then we meet Jack Palance at the studio.
Cinecittà.
With another great long tracking shot.
Which is kind of like, it's not literally the shot we're looking at during the credits, but it's sort of the same, you know, it's the same location, same setup with the dolly and everything, which is kind of interesting. But when we see it during the credits, it's just Francesco walking.
Right.
And then, when the film begins, suddenly it's Michel Piccoli, Francesca, and Jack Palance.
And Palance's entrance in like that whole first bit is so great.
It was so funny to me when I saw this for the first time, because really my only like knowledge of Jack Palance basically was, City Slickers and Batman.
Oh,
and,
sure.
And the time that he like did push-ups on the stage at the Oscars. Those were like the reference points I had for Jack Palance. So it was funny to see him younger and earlier.
My brother worked with him. He was an AD on City Slickers too.
Oh, that's awesome.
And it was like one of those things where Palance was you had to mind your P's and Q's.
Yeah,
he was cantankerous.
Yeah.
Exactly how you would think he would be.
Yeah.
There was one story where Scott was trying to because, you know, your job as a second AD, go get him from the trailer,
right?
Walk him to the set. If it's an old man like this, you're out in the desert.
Yeah.
You know. Look out for the rock, Mr. Palance, stuff like that.
Right.
And he like totally tore him an asshole one day about like, I see the rock. I can walk there on my own.
Oh, no.
One of those kinds of things. Man, you were actually yelled at by Jack Palance.
That's pretty great.
That's great.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, that's like, you did the thing, you got the t-shirt.
Yeah, he wasn't too bad of a guy or anything, but he was pretty cantankerous.
And apparently it was contentious, you know, obviously contentious with Godard as well.
So he was as a young man. That's just his personality, I guess.
Yeah, I think, I mean, he came from a whole different school of acting, a whole different era of cinema.
Sure.
It's like they've got him out in Europe and he's making this art film. And
this
director who
that.
Like speaks in riddles and, you know, it's just
probably
like
confused.
Yeah, he's probably just kind of like, what am I doing here? You know, what is this thing?
This
picture's going to stink, you know?
Like young Jack Palance.
Yeah.
So handsome and like
that square, powerful.
Yeah,
like,
and just menacing. And the way he plays this part is I mean, this movie could have been so different in someone else's hands.
Sure.
This story.
Yeah.
But this is so not straightforward because it's Godard. Like, you're trying to figure it out half the time. I always felt like I was behind
a
few minutes.
That's always the case in his films, and especially with, like, the density of the references. They're constantly kind of quoting from, like, Dante and Homer, of course, and Hölderlin comes up at one point. And for me, it's very difficult when a quotation is kind of broken up over several subtitles and there's maybe other on-screen action happening in between.
Right.
It's very – like there's something so slippery about it. It's very, very difficult to retain and to actually kind of like figure out what the significance of them saying that was, if there was, if they weren't just kind of, you know, like hanging out and quoting stuff.
Repeat viewing is kind of key a lot of times for that.
But his films, especially as they progress, there's this a sense in which you are, like you said, perpetually like behind the film and just struggling to – kind of catch up, keep up the pace.
Yeah.
He works a lot more in his other films with multiple layers of sound and having, you know, characters speak over each other.
Yeah.
Sometimes a voiceover comes in over a dialogue and they're mixed so that you can kind of hear both, again, kind of like Altman.
Right.
But yeah, sometimes he'll have, you know, one voice coming out of the left channel, one voice coming out of the right channel, different languages.
Yeah.
All kind of like bumping up against each other.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, there's like a critical tendency to want to slow things down.
Right.
And like account for all that stuff.
Uh-huh.
And I think there's certainly merit in doing that. But at the same time, I also think that sometimes people kind of miss the forest for the trees in terms of like the overall effect he's creating, where he wants you to almost be like overwhelmed with meaning, overwhelmed with significance.
Just sit there and take it all
exactly.
in.
Exactly. It's almost
maybe
like
try
music.
And figure it out later.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get that.
And his later films especially are so dense with like allusions, and you have to have like a doctorate in philosophy, you know, to really understand some of the things that he's talking about. And again, like I think some people look at those films and they say, well, this is just, I give up, you know?
Yeah.
There's no way I'm going to understand this. But he also at the same time has so much like formal beauty and just like the musicality of things, his use of sound as a whole, you know, becomes like interesting on its own terms without having to like get down and like check every reference he's making and so on.
Right. Yeah. And I thought the speaking of music, just the use of that beautiful score.
Georges Delerue,
When it would come in, I mean, it was all over the place. And it almost at times felt like a joke.
Exactly.
Like a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek use of it.
Oh, yeah.
And then I read afterward that, you know, this even described as a comedy drama.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, okay. Because I picked up on a couple of things.
Yeah.
I was like, is this supposed to be funny? Or
I
just sort
really
of like,
laugh out loud. I mean, there's a few moments that
I mean,
are
definitely
pretty
not
funny.
Laugh out loud. Yeah. But I think a little tongue-in-cheek clever.
Sure.
You know, Godard messing with people a little bit.
Yeah, there's definitely moments like Jack Palance has a few really good line readings.
Yeah,
like where when Michel Piccoli has been late to arrive at Jack Palance's place, and he's kind of floundering and he's trying to explain in like terrible English what happened to him.
Uh-huh.
Jack Palance just kind of listens and he's like, yeah, you know,
right.
He like lowers the shades over his eyes. He's just like, yeah, man, you're in trouble. You are in the doghouse.
They have that first in the screening room, that great scene.
Yeah.
And talk about over the top. I mean, he's just when he's throwing the film cans and even does the discus move at one
point. Fritz Lang has that great line. He's like, finally you get the, you know, the feel of Greek culture or something like that when he does the discus throw of the film reel.
Well, which is funny though, because he also messes up later when he gives him the book of the great art of Rome.
Yeah.
And he says that
the Odyssey is Greek.
The Odyssey is
he's
Greek.
Like, I know.
He's I know. And then she translates. He says, I know. There was so much of that wordplay with the translation going on.
Yeah.
It's kind of fun. But then we finally get Brigitte Bardot, or Brigitte Bardot, brought into that world. And from the moment, you know, he peels around the corner in that sports car, you just sort of know what's going on. But it's not overt.
Well,
he's not overtly flirting, but you can tell just by the nature of big Hollywood producer, bombshell, screenwriter wife, what's going to happen.
It's, even like you said, when the car first pulls around the corner, you know, it physically cuts the two of them off, Michel Piccoli and Brigitte Bardot, it comes in between them.
Uh-huh.
It passes between them at like kind of like a high speed, and it's kind of
right.
Godard is – he loves to use car sounds, and that's something that car horns and engine sounds and, you know, things revving up. That's something that like happens over and over and over again in his films. Oftentimes the car horns are mixed like just painfully loud.
Yeah.
Weekend especially, there's this tracking shot that goes on for like 10 minutes of this traffic jam, and it's nothing but car horns for like 10 whole minutes and people yelling at each other, and it's kind of like a metaphor for like society,
so
you know, kind of falling apart.
He's the consummate art house filmmaker.
He really is, yeah. It's hard to get much more arty, you know, than Godard, although not in like a boring sort of like... I don't know what you would call it, like
Jim Morrison,
exactly. There's nothing like sophomoric about it. It's very like I said, it's not an affectation for him. It's just his culture. It's just his world.
Like I wonder what and maybe you know this. I'm sure you've read plenty about him, but I wonder what his intent is and his. I wonder if he cares about entertaining an audience. Sometimes,
no, certainly not. No.
Different way of filmmaking.
Yeah, then. I don't think he ever has. I think he's been quoted as saying like, "I make films to pass the time."
Interesting.
Which he's known for his sort of like provocative aphorisms
sure.
and things he says about cinema that he may only like half
poking
really
the bear.
Believe.
Yeah,
yeah,
right.
yeah. But no, he's always had I think a rather like antagonistic attitude towards the viewer in some ways.
So
I mean,
interesting.
At a deeper level, he's making films. He said this like later on in life that he's making films for like a few hundred people in the world that
Casey and
that kind of are on the wavelength and like, you know, the hardcore cinephiles, the people that whatever, you know, that's like who he has in mind. He's not at all thinking about like trying to have a commercial success.
Yeah, it's kind of Terrence Malick-esque.
Yeah, sure.
In some ways.
And I mean, I think both filmmakers are really like, I think there's such like a generosity there if you're on that wavelength
right.
of like he's just – there's like a real sincerity behind it.
Uh-huh.
I don't think he's somebody that wants to – like he's not setting out to alienate an audience per se, I don't think. I
right.
don't think he just wants
– like this will really confuse everyone.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, sure.
I think the films would fall apart and get really tedious and boring and uninteresting.
I don't know that he's thinking about them at all.
Yeah, I think
the
he's
people.
Just – I mean, he's obviously making the film he wants to make that he would want to see that.
And that's it.
And, you know, he like I said, he began as a film critic and he has largely not written film criticism since he started making films.
Mm-hmm.
He has a little bit, but he kind of says that now his films are his film criticism. So
right.
like when he makes a film.
That's his statement.
It's like his statement on what he's been seeing lately, mm-hmm. what he's been thinking about,
wow.
the filmmakers that maybe he's responding to at that time and the ones that he's also reacting against.
Yeah.
And then even later in his career, like in the 80s and 90s, he starts to make what are properly called like essay films,
uh-huh.
which are almost more of a hybrid between documentary, narrative.
Oh, interesting.
And just kind of this free form like spoken word
uh-huh.
kind of essay on cinema or on history or
are they
so
good?
On. Yeah. I mean, they're fascinating. Like Histoire du Cinéma, he worked on for, I think, well over a decade.
Wow.
It's this compendium of all these different clips from the history of cinema. And he calls it Histoire du Cinéma. Histoire in French can mean either history or story.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same word for both. And there's like an S in parentheses at the end of Histoire, which also suggests like it's not just one history.
Oh, interesting.
It's like all these different angles on history. And
right.
it's like it's a
and
very
this
personal.
Is just his.
Yeah, it's a very personal history because it's not like, you know, the film 101 where you just kind of start at the beginning and move linearly through it.
Right.
It's very heavily weighted to his own life, his own kind of, you know, thoughts on cinema, what he considers important.
Uh-huh.
And he obviously ignores vast amounts of cinema that, you know, in a more kind of film study sense, you should probably be talking about.
But, right.
It's all just about his own. It's almost like his own autobiography, like through the cinema.
Right. That's awesome. So they go to Jack Palance's house, his estate or whatever.
His villa.
His villa, which is gorgeous. One of his villas. And there's this tension going on that you don't know where it's coming from, really, because he's not overt with anything.
Mm-hmm.
He's not overtly flirting with her. who's Piccolo?
Yeah, Piccoli. Yeah,
Piccoli. He's hardly paying attention.
Yeah,
which is part of the problem in the marriage.
Right.
But there's tension between everyone.
Yeah.
There's no one feels comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Or comes across as comfortable.
Sure.
The assistant woman, she doesn't feel comfortable. She doesn't seem very happy.
Well, she knows. She sees what Prokosh is doing with Brigitte Bardot, that he's got his eyes on her.
Right, but it's still not super overt.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very subtle. But I think, like, for instance, when Michelle Piccoli goes in the house to wash his hands.
Right.
And he notices that Francesca has, like, been crying.
Uh-huh.
I think that's because she kind of picked up on that, like, Prokosh has kind of got a new love interest or something.
Right. And, of course, this beautiful blonde comes in and obviously is a threat.
Yeah.
Even if there is no overt flirtation going on. But that whole sequence, you know, there's this stuff, like I said, Godard doesn't hand you anything. Like, he hands you so little, you wonder if you miss something.
Sure.
Sometimes.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Because there's that period where he's inside with her, the playwright, and whatever, it's like 30 minutes or something passes.
Yeah.
And he comes back out, and you think that maybe something had happened because everything changed after that. And that's what, we'll get to the apartment argument.
Yeah.
But a lot of that was like, what happened when I was gone? What happened?
Yeah.
And there's no flashback. There's no, you don't know. Did something happen?
At one point, like Michelle Piccoli, he walks over to Brigitte Bardot. She's flipping through that book of art.
Right.
And he's kind of like, he's kind of rubbing her leg. And he's just trying to reestablish like some rapport there and kind of be like, hey, what's the matter? You know, you've been acting funny. And he says to her at one point, he's like, what, did he hit on you or something?
Right.
And she just says, why do you ask me that?
Yeah, it's not confirmed.
Yeah.
But I think something did happen probably.
Well, I think her response, why did you ask me that, is sort of like, yeah, he probably did, you know?
Right.
And you should have seen that coming a mile away.
Yeah, yeah.
Why did you let me get in the car with him?
Well,
you know?
And are you using me?
Exactly.
Like, I did read some criticism of the film afterward, and that was very much one of the things that everyone touched on was the fact that she was upset because she felt like he may have been using her.
Pimping her out.
Yeah, kind
basically.
Of pimping her out.
Yeah. I mean, I think that when, like, having seen the movie a bunch of times now, I think that really is literally the key moment when they're going to go from, you know, that first location to the screening room.
Right.
And they have to drive over there. And
he goes with her alone.
Yeah, and Prokosh says, you know, get in the car. And then she gets in, and then Michelle Piccoli goes to kind of sit in the back. And he goes, oh no, you won't be comfortable back there.
Yeah,
you know, just take a taxi or do something. I don't really care. Or we'll drive back and get you or something.
So does he give in to that too quick?
He gives in way
and
too
like,
quick. Yeah,
sure, sure.
Because she's looking at him
to like rescue
and she's,
her,
and she's saying basically, yeah, tell him no, tell him that we will both take a taxi and we'll see him over there.
Right.
But instead, you know, she's kind of looking at him. She's just giving him a look with her eyes.
Right, right.
Like, hey, help me out here. Like, I don't want you to say yes to this. And Michelle Piccoli's reaction is completely just like nonchalant. He's just kind of like, no, that's fine. Go, go.
Yeah, but that's interesting because when I read that scene, I am that husband going, oh, no, it's fine.
Yeah,
just get in the car.
Like, I trust you. It's fine.
Trusting and like, what's the big deal?
Yeah.
But she sees that as an offense.
Yeah. Yeah, they're looking at the same situation in two completely different ways.
And that
is like the grand theme of the film is like people seeing things differently, how that translation, how language can really obscure like the true meaning of things and how people can be at cross purposes and talking past each other and not communicating even though there's just like this like never-ending flow of words. But it's the inability of language to truly capture like what's going on in a given situation. And, of course, that even flows into all the conversations and debates that Fritz Lang and Prokosh and Piccoli have about, you know, the meaning of the Odyssey, the interpretation of the Odyssey, that, like, Fritz Lang wants to stay true to the spirit of the original.
Mm-hmm.
He says, you know, this was written at a time when people were very simple, when the world was very literal, things like meant what they meant and they were what they were. There wasn't all this like neurosis and double meanings and sort of passive aggressiveness and all that. And you know, Prokosh wants to make the film modern and he wants to basically make kind of like a psychological version where maybe it's about the hero Ulysses like and his wife Penelope like having marital problems, and
right.
that's why he stays away for 10 years and all this kind of stuff. And
it's very playful, like, the way they use the Odyssey, to mirror kind of what's going on in this story,
And Fritz Lang is just kind of like, well, no, that's not the Odyssey then. That's something different. And the Francesca character is like the embodiment of that as well. The way they say things in one language and she has to translate it. And when she does the translation, sometimes she does leave things out, or sometimes she changes the meaning of things. And it's
that
all
was
that.
Really cool.
Yeah.
Every time Jack Palance has an invite or something, he said, you know, ask her if she's going to do something, something, yes or no.
Yeah.
He's like, he doesn't want any of the fluff.
Exactly.
Like, yes or no.
Just very binary.
Every single time.
Just very like, yeah.
So all this tension is set up, and it's really a film, and it's a prologue and then three acts. You
sure.
know, you have the prologue with the nude scene.
Right.
And then these three very clear acts. And that whole second act is it's pretty intense, but it's one of those things where he's playing with space.
Yeah.
He's playing with words. You talked a second ago about how they're talking in this film, but they're not. No one's acknowledging what the other's saying.
Right.
In this middle part, and the entire film, but this whole middle section of them two in the apartment, they're just talking at each other.
Yeah.
And they're not acknowledging what the other's saying, and then responding to that.
Yeah.
And it reminded me of a lot of stuff. One of the things it really reminded me of was, and I'm sure he had to have gotten, but is the Butch and Fabian hotel scene in Pulp Fiction.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
When they're just in there and it's like, you don't know how much time is passing. It's kind of unclear.
Right.
They're just sort of talking at each other.
Yeah.
And then I looked up, of course, and Tarantino is hugely influenced by Godard.
He called his production company Band Apart for a long
Band
time.
Yeah, Band Apart. Exactly.
Yeah, that's a very interesting like tangent, Tarantino and Godard, because Godard kind of hates Tarantino.
Oh, does he?
He's made multiple statements, because I think obviously in the early 90s when Tarantino first appeared on the scene with Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
Made a big splash at Cannes and so on. Pulp Fiction won the Palme d'Or.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, suddenly there's like this new breath of fresh air in cinema.
Yeah.
Like everybody suddenly wants to be Tarantino, and you have all these like lookalike movies.
Totally.
A lot of which were terrible, I think. But of course, Tarantino himself.
You didn't like Things to Do in Denver when you're dead?
No.
Or 2 Days in the Valley?
Yeah, exactly. Or like Boondock Saints or
Boondock
whatever.
Saints, yeah. Sure. The list goes on.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Tarantino is sort of like Nirvana in that the thing in itself is great.
Mm-hmm.
Tarantino is great. Nirvana is great. All the sort of like wannabe imitators, not
right.
so great.
Yeah.
But yeah, people started asking Godard like, oh, do you like Quentin Tarantino? Because he called
sure.
his production company a Band Apart. And,
you know,
he says he loves your films, and there's like references to your films in his movies and so on. Like the haircut that Uma Thurman has in Pulp Fiction is very, very similar to Anna Karina's haircut,
right?
Who was kind of Godard's muse in the 60s.
Yeah.
They were married for a number of years.
Uh-huh.
And even in this film, Contempt, when it's Brigitte Bardot, as this film is being made, that's also when Godard's own marriage to Karina is kind of like falling apart.
Oh, really?
And he has her in that apartment scene put on the black wig.
Yeah, the black wig.
And that is basically, that's literally like the Anna Karina hair.
Oh,
so interesting. He has Brigitte Bardot dressed up like his wife that
right.
he's fighting with, you know, when he's not on set.
But did he poo-poo Tarantino, and was he just like, no?
Well, he poo-pooed him big time. He basically, and Godard has made a lot of provocative statements.
Yeah.
But yeah, he does not really like fundamentally respect what Tarantino is doing. I think a lot of people want to draw comparisons between the two
mm-hmm.
because they both draw on so much film culture,
yeah.
references to things, like meta-textuality in their films and
uh-huh.
so on. But, you know, Godard thinks that Tarantino does that in like a gross American Hollywood.
Right. Of course he does.
Commercial capitalistic way.
Sure.
And, you know, for him, it has nothing to do with what he does.
Right.
And Tarantino's just like a fan of a lot of different films. You know, he's
yeah.
a fan of like the really high art stuff like Godard, but he also loves the schlocky stuff.
Oh, yeah.
He's not precious about the kind of films that he will praise. And I think...
What was Tarantino's response?
I don't know if Tarantino has really said much, although I did notice
on... Hurt?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure he probably did, but I don't remember him really replying very much to, you know, when he was asked about this, because it has happened over a number of years. Like,
yeah.
this has been an ongoing thing.
I'm sure.
Even, I think even when Godard was promoting maybe Goodbye to Language, which came out in like 2014. Mm-hmm. I believe he gave an interview where Tarantino came up and he called him a faucon, a pauvre type or something, which is like a just kind of like a jerk, kind of like a schmuck or something.
I'm laughing.
So the conflict goes on, and I did notice on like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, like it's a different production company name now.
Oh,
it's
really?
Not Band Apart anymore. Yeah,
he finally got rid of it. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, let's talk about the apartment scene. It's really long. Not much happens, but sort of a lot happens at the same time.
Yeah.
I mean, they could have called the film "Should I Go to Capri?"
Yes. Should I go to Capri? Should I rewrite the script?
Yeah. Should I go?
Should
to Capri?
Should I take this job?
Should I take this job?
Yeah.
Because that is so much of what is going on. And Why Don't You Love Me?
Yeah.
Because you love me this morning.
Yeah. What the hell happened?
Yeah.
What did I do?
Such an interesting 30 minutes of film.
And it's like there's almost really nothing else like it. Except in Breathless, actually, there's a sequence kind of in the middle of that film where the two of them like finally like go to like a hotel room or something. And they're kind of in there for a long time also. I don't think as long, but maybe 15, 20 minutes of screen time.
Yeah, but Breathless had such an energy with all the jump cutting.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Stuff.
It's way more frenetic.
Yeah.
And this actually feels it's a style that's kind of unusual for Godard to like stay in one time period like that in like real time.
But it's funny because it is real time. But there's this weird sense of how much time has passed at the same time.
Yeah, because it does feel like sometimes maybe there are like ellipses and things that
maybe
it's jumping forward a little bit or.
But it's pretty much real time.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like it's sort of like you're just seeing the inner life of a relationship kind of play out, you know, and you're seeing all the ways in which they're kind of like having little snipes at each other and
how they're broken
in
so many ways, but not in some like depressing way. It's just sort of like,
ugh, this relationship is kind of done.
They're misfiring.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's no connection.
There's no trust the way he, you know, he quizzes her like, you know, I called your mom's at lunchtime today and she didn't pick up. And then when they're in the apartment and her mom calls, it's obvious
he
that
says
he
she's
wants
not here.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
he wants to say like, hey, so what have you done today or something?
Yeah,
just kind of make sure the stories line up.
Yeah.
And that's when she, you know, she like kicks him and she's like,
shut the door and she won't even talk in
front
of
like,
him.
If you start up with that, I will divorce you. Don't start. Yeah.
Yeah, it really goes bad quickly. You know, she said she's, and that's with the passage of time, like she's, one of them's taking a bath, and the other one takes a bath, and then she says, I'm moving out here to sleep, but it's daytime. He looks like he's getting ready to go out.
Yeah.
So I was completely disoriented as to, like, what time of day it was. It could have been morning, for all I know.
Yeah, I think it's like, to me, it feels like it's, like, mid-afternoon, because by the time they're done, and they actually, like, do go get in the car and go to that screening, it's, like, evening at that point.
Right.
So I think it's kind of like sort of like we watch their afternoon kind of after their morning. But as far as her like going to the couch, I think that's more just kind of like she's saying like, I'm going to sleep out here from now on.
Yeah.
But not necessarily that like it's nighttime, I'm going to bed now, but it's just her way of like withdrawing from, you know, the relationship.
And it's all set up for later, I guess, when she does want to go to bed.
Yeah.
But it's also so confusing because there's so much, they say so many things that counter what they had just said.
Yeah.
You know, I don't love you anymore. And like at first, it's him suspecting that she doesn't love him.
Yeah.
And she's like, what are you talking about? Then she's basically saying, I don't love you.
Yeah.
And he's like, but you love me this morning. But then she's like, forget everything I said.
Yeah.
And is that look one of what, admiration or
contempt?
I don't think, does he say contempt?
She uses the word contempt, le mépris. I think she says "je te mépris" when she's going to leave, when she's like finally had it, and she's walking down the stairs, and she says, you know, basically, I don't love you anymore. I hate you.
Yeah,
I can't feel anything for you,
right?
Other than my intense dislike of you.
Yeah.
So
harsh.
Yeah. Yeah.
What is the magic here? That's like, because when you're watching it as someone who's never seen much Godard like me, and I'm looking at it through the lens of trying to do the show, so yeah. I'm really studying it. But a casual viewer might be annoyed at that scene.
Oh, for sure.
Think nothing happened.
Yeah.
Or that was fucking confusing.
Yeah.
What is the magic of it that is so, like,
compelling?
Why am I thinking about it today?
Yeah.
Because nothing does happen much, and it is confusing.
It's true.
And it does feel like he's fucking with the audience a little bit.
Well, I mean, I think you do have the use of space, like we've been saying. Like, it's so... It's like a masterclass in blocking and the usage of...
Yeah, it's like a stage play.
Yeah, of the space to really emphasize and intensify the disconnect that's happening verbally in the relationship.
They feel trapped.
Yeah, yeah.
Physically.
It's like a big apartment, but it feels very claustrophobic because there's these two people there that are absolutely not getting along and that are just like on each other's nerves constantly. And I don't know. I think there's something very relatable about that.
Maybe.
I think in a way, like when I first saw the film many times, I identified more with the Michelle Peakley character. Mm-hmm. I kind of identified with that dilemma of like, really, what did I do? Like, what was so bad that suddenly like the whole marriage is falling apart? Now I tend to see things a little more from Brigitte Bardot's perspective.
Uh-huh.
I can at least understand all the reasons that she has for suddenly really not liking her husband anymore, beginning with the thing, you know, with Prokosh in the car.
Right.
But also I think another key thing is the way that Peakley wants to defer to her on what to do about should we go to Capri, should I do this job or not. I think really – for her, what it feels like is that he's not a man. He's not somebody that decides that has like integrity, that is guided by his own like principles.
Right.
But instead, he just wants to placate her. So he's like, whatever's going to calm the situation down, I'll do that. Just tell me and I'll do it, you know?
And she's like, just make up your own mind about something. Because it's not like, I think she wants him to be principled. I think that's a good take on it.
Yeah.
She doesn't want to be told what to do because... Even though she's asking him to tell her what to do.
Right.
It's very tricky.
Yeah, yeah.
Because earlier in the film, she has that one line where she said, basically, like, don't ask me. My husband makes those decisions for me or something like that.
Yeah, right, right.
And she says it with spite.
Yeah.
So she's almost insatiable in that she wants him to make the decision, but she also has contempt because he's making these decisions for her.
Yeah, it's like it's so many contradictions.
Yes.
And I think – that's part of what makes it fascinating and kind of maddening to watch because there isn't a lot of consistency. There isn't a lot of there's no logic. It's purely emotional. It's intuitive, and it's very fluid.
Though.
Absolutely, I think that's the case more often than not.
Yeah.
In a relationship, it's not about what's logical. It's just about how people are feeling, really.
Yeah.
And like when you try to tackle a problem like that with pure logic, you don't get very far. Like it doesn't.
No,
you know, you can't like reason your way out of something like that.
Yeah, and oftentimes in a relationship, one person is coming from a place of emotion, and one person is coming from a place of logic.
It's that conflict.
Yeah,
and but I think, I think she wants him to assert himself.
Right,
and I think that, like I said, I think he's a character that is just he's kind of lost his way. Like he's a little bit unsure of who he is, who he wants to be.
Yeah.
And to her, that plays as weakness and it plays as, a bad kind of vulnerability where he's just kind of like wishy-washy and go with it. And she's just kind of like, who am I married to? Who is this person?
Yeah, it's interesting casting too because I read up a little bit more about her. She was not shy with men.
Right, right.
Had a series of marriages and a series of affairs.
Right.
Like her first marriage, she had like two different affairs. And then during one affair, she cheated with another man. And
I think she was married to like Roger Vadim at one point.
Roger Vadim, they were
who
married.
Who made In God Created Woman, which is sort of like what?
She cheated on him twice.
Yeah, yeah. That film came out in like the late 50s and it was kind of like, you know, it sort of was a revolution in terms of sexuality on the screen.
Yeah.
And like the sensuality of Brigitte Bardot and just like her body and the way she moved and the way she like behaved and so on was just kind of like, boom, here is like modern woman, you know, liberated, like overtly sexual,
right.
Not what we're used to seeing in like classical Hollywood.
Yeah, she's kind of still alive too. I didn't realize.
She's still alive. She has not been involved in filmmaking since the early 70s.
Yeah.
She's one kinda of those that kind of like dropped out of the industry, mm-hmm. and she's had a really like problematic life after after the cinema. She's an animal rights activist, okay. but she's also like extremely like kind of racist xenophobic figure.
Oh, really?
She identifies, like supports the far right in France, the Le Pen government.
Oh, interesting.
Which is kind of like very nationalist, anti-immigrant party.
Right.
And she's been fined in France. They have fines for, you know, making statements that could be, you know, described as like inciting violence or racist or whatever.
Oh, wow.
She's been fined like 5 times.
We should get on that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I know, right?
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, the scene is just, it's unlike anything else I'd seen in movies,
yeah.
how long it goes on. And we keep talking about how they play with space. There's something about, and if you've ever been in a relationship where you've lived with someone or you're married and live in the same place, obviously, the claustrophobia of being in an argument and chasing each other around the house, basically.
Right. Yes.
I'm going in here, then yes. they come in here.
Exactly.
So I'm going to go in here. But it's not singular in this movie. They're kind of chasing each other around the
yeah,
apartment.
Sometimes one pursues the other and then the shoe's on the other foot and
yeah.
the roles reverse. And, you know, now it's him trying to get away from her.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, some time passes and suddenly it's flipped.
And the power shift again is
yeah.
just constant.
The constant ebb and flow and the kind of the playfulness of her like reading from a Fritz Lang book
right.
in the bathtub, or him wearing the Dean Martin hat and so on, and mm-hmm. her wearing the wig to look like Anna Karenina. And,
him putting on a toga, essentially.
Yeah, and kind of like, yeah, become like a classical Greek like figure. And
yeah, man, that's
yeah.
so good.
Yeah.
Oh, man, that red, red couch.
Yeah.
And again, with the red robes and the yellow robes, like those primary colors are just like jumping off the screen.
It reminds me, the red furniture reminds me of the red furniture in 2001 when they're on
yeah.
that station before they get to the main base.
Yeah, yeah.
But where they have like that conversation, it's that kind of, yeah, Godard was like very, very into super bold primary colors. The production design for all of his like 60s films
uh-huh.
are have that kind of color palette. And yeah, they just kind of pop off the screen, and there's something very like pop art, almost like comic book about them.
Mm-hmm.
The just like in terms of the boldness and the kind of the graphic nature of the frame is
yeah.
very, very interesting.
Yeah, what a sequence! And did read a little bit about it, like I said, and it's revered in film history. It's
yeah.
just one of the most amazing sequences of film.
Yeah.
Where nothing happens.
Yeah. Another film that, you know, that Godard, I think, was being influenced quite a bit by, that he references overtly in this film, Roberto Rossellini's Voyage to Italy, or Voyage in Italy,
uh-huh.
Which is on the marquee when they come out of the screening later on, the one that they go to at night.
Mm-hmm.
It's like on the marquee. There's posters and so on. That's a film that Rossellini made with Ingrid Bergman,
mm-hmm.
Who he was having an affair with.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about a marriage that is falling apart. And it's about a couple that goes to Italy on vacation as sort of like a last ditch effort to kind of
right.
save their marriage, mm-hmm. kind of. And they're there for other reasons too, but that's kind of the unspoken goal of the trip.
For Capri?
Yeah, uh-huh. yeah. And so, yeah, it again, it's – that film, Voyage in Italy, is kind of credited with being like one of the first like truly quote-unquote modernist works of cinema
yeah.
where it is about, you know, it's not the happy Hollywood ending. It's about mm-hmm. uncertainty and things not working out and
right.
and basically just watching this, you know, what was once like a loving relationship,
yeah.
you know, come to its end essentially.
Yeah, but without much melodrama and there's not a lot of – she displays a bit of emotion. He displays hardly any. He's just playing confused most
yeah,
of the time.
Other than just kind of persistence. There's the
yeah.
whole red herring with the gun.
Well, yeah, that's what we need to talk about.
Yeah.
Talk about a red herring.
Chekhov's, you know,
yeah, I mean,
sort
he
of
just
reversing
like,
that.
Not only reverses it, but like gives it the full fucking middle finger, I think.
Yeah.
He just inexplicably takes this gun from behind some books.
Yeah.
And you're like, all right, well.
Oof. What's going to happen?
And I did not know how the movie ended, and we'll obviously get there, but I fully thought he would honor that
yeah.
you know,
right.
time-tested tradition and kill them both in Capri.
Yeah.
I was waiting for that. And I was like, when's he going to shoot him?
Yeah. And you're kind of like, there's even a moment later on where I think it's Francesca like says like, oh, here, I found your gun or something.
Yeah.
And gives it to
Fritz
him.
Lang was like, you know, you shouldn't play with guns.
Children shouldn't play with guns. It's a very cutting comment.
Well, but it's interesting that he doesn't use it because I think that is that character. He's not even man enough to do
that. Right, exactly. He's not going to
shoot anyone.
Not that it would be quote-unquote heroic, but he's not part of like the active, you know, like decisive tradition. Uh-huh. He is just indecisive and neurotic and he can't commit to anything.
Everything is reactive.
Yeah, and so he would never take the initiative to like shoot somebody.
He doesn't have that much gumption.
Yeah. It's funny, like there's a detail when they're arguing in the apartment that she notices he has a membership card to the Italian Communist Party.
Oh, is that what that was?
Yeah.
Okay, I wasn't sure.
And she's like, you didn't tell me you signed up for this. He's like, oh, that's a few weeks ago in Paris I joined. Which I think that's a very interesting thing because again,
it's a big thing in a marriage to not know.
Yeah, exactly. And also, I think it's just another indication that they're not communicating. They're not talking. He does something like that, and he doesn't even mention it to her. And also, it shows his own inner kind of contradiction still, mm-hmm. because on the one hand, he's sort of like, I can make all this money and buy this nice apartment, but on the other hand, he's like a member of the Communist Party. I mean, obviously, there's a long tradition of people pointing at people that are on the left and being like, oh, you have a house. Like, how could you do that?
Right.
You know? But really, like, he does seem like he's motivated by wanting to provide this glitzier lifestyle for her.
And he even says that outright a bunch of times. Yeah. Like, you know, I took this job
it's
for
like,
you,
I'm doing
basically.
It just for you. If I do this job, which I don't want to do, it would be out of love for you as a sacrifice to provide for you.
Right.
And she's kind of, you know, she says at one point, like, we were fine when you were just the struggling playwright and we didn't have any money. And I was a typist and it was, you know, we loved each other. We had a great relationship then. And like now there's money, there's things, but mm-hmm. like, it's not the same. We like you're kind of missing the point. If you think that it's just about these materialistic kind of concerns, really, for her, like, she wants, like, a genuine relationship, not to just be, like, provided for, you know?
Yeah. The other thing that it reminded me of, the apartment scene especially, was Hal Hartley's early stuff.
Sure.
I don't know if you've seen much of that.
What have I seen of Hal Hartley? Yeah, like Trust or...
Trust, yeah. The Unbelievable Truth.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Hartley is super influenced by Godard.
Yeah, you could tell. And my brother hated Hal Hartley movies. And he would probably hate Godard, but he was just like, I don't get it, man. They're just talking around each other and no one's acknowledging what the other's saying. It's sort of melodramatic at times. And
Like Hal Hartley, I love his music that he composes under the moniker of Ned Rifle. Hartley draws also a lot on like the 80s films of Godard, mm-hmm. where there are these very deliberate static framings that again are very much like almost like panels in a comic book or mm-hmm. something where characters are – one's looking off this side of the screen, the other's looking this other way. They're clearly not connecting and there's definitely like a phoniness in a way, like an artificiality to it. That is deliberately meant to interrupt any kind of like hypnotic connection we might make with the film where we forget we're watching a movie and we just become engrossed in it. You know, Hal Hartley's definitely always trying to kind of force us to remember we're watching a fiction, we're watching a movie.
Right.
This is kind of...
You can't get lost in a Hal Hartley
movie.
Yeah,
because
it's
you're
not
constantly
reality.
Like your concentration is always being broken up by these indicators that what you're watching is a movie.
Yeah, it's always one level back from real life.
Yeah.
There's this weird artifice.
Yeah.
Arty artifice.
Yeah. There's a great great interview that Godard did with Hal Hartley in the early 90s, I think around 95 or so. Hartley, you know, had given interviews and talked about how much he loved Godard and so on. And Godard was actually very fond of some of the early Hal Hartley films too.
Yeah.
So he's like, we should meet and talk. And they did and they wrote it up. And it's a fascinating interview. It's really, really good. You can find it on the internet. And then even more recently, Hal Hartley actually did a commentary track for one of Godard's films that was issued again on Blu-ray.
Makes sense, then.
Hail Mary. It's a great, great commentary.
Yeah. I'd like to see... some good old school Hal Hartley, because Trust, Simple Man, Unbelievable Truth, Surviving Desire was the other one that I can think of. So love those movies. And then he did the sort of trilogy with the Henry Fool, Faye Grimm.
Right.
And I guess, was Ned Reifel the other thing?
Yeah, yeah. Ned Reifel, I think, is the third part of that series.
I did like Amateur, actually.
Yeah, yeah. Amateur's cool.
But I kind of like Flirt, too. But I would like to see him go back and do sort of just that old school Hartley Godard type of thing again.
He did one somewhat recently, I think, called Meanwhile. I think that's the title.
Oh, yeah?
That to me felt like a little bit of a return to that form.
Yeah, like 8 years ago.
Yeah.
I did not see that one. I tried to get him on the show, actually.
Yeah, oh, man, that'd be great. Was he not responsive?
I did get some response from someone in his camp that, like, he would have done it, but he couldn't or something. It wasn't like a firm no. It was like, hey, maybe so.
Try. I would say try again. He's pretty approachable. I had like a little bit of correspondence with him because he's done several Kickstarter campaigns to fund. I think Faye Grimm was Kickstarted, maybe Ned Reifel too. And he's also sort of he's purchased the rights to his films, so that now he's like the distributor owner for them.
Yeah.
And so he has Kickstarted like restorations and Blu-ray releases and all that kind of stuff. So when he made one of his films, he actually had this thing on Kickstarter where you could buy the distribution rights for these different countries.
Really?
And they were going for like not that much, you know, for like a film.
Uh-huh.
So it was maybe like 5-10 grand or something to buy like the distribution rights for like France. And so I wrote to him on Kickstarter. I was like, you know, I know nothing about film distribution, but I'm kind of tempted to do this. And he's like, no, please don't. If you're not like, you know, I don't want my film to just be like unseeable because somebody bought it for the heck of it. And then they actually made him take those down because there's this whole other thing with Kickstarter where you can't really sell like points or whatever.
Sure.
You know, you basically have to just say, I'm sending this money away with no expectation of return other than the bonuses or whatever.
Yeah. So in the end of that second act, and I can't even remember now who fucking decides, or do they decide who's going to Capri?
Is that even established,
or are they just in Capri?
Well, they come out of the theater where they've been watching that weird onstage performance,
right?
And
when the music would stop,
So very cool, Godard. He does that all the time, and there's a line sort of like, it does seem like they've just kind of decided they've less decided than just kind of given in, you know?
Because she's kind of like, ask my husband, right?
Yeah, she says, ask my husband, and then she has this line where she says, you know, it's not you that's forcing me to go to Capri, it's life. It's just the course of things, you know, it's just the way things are going, it's just kind of the world as it is.
Right.
That's why I have to go to Capri.
And the next thing you see basically
cuts to her on the boat.
Yeah, her face.
Back with the blonde hair again.
Yeah,
and
that
the sunglasses.
Blonde hair and that just blue water behind her.
Yeah.
And that amazing villa where they shoot this film.
Yeah.
With a crew of like 5 people.
Yeah, it's a small crew.
It's kind of funny.
And Godard is actually playing the assistant director.
I saw that.
Running around with the bullhorn and telling everybody to get in their place and so on. Yeah.
The third act is it feels like there's more suspicion going on. But again, because it's Godard, it's not some overt. Like he uses that same score. He doesn't use any like heightening of tension.
It's like that one cue over and over again. Yeah.
Which is beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
But it's not like he doesn't do with music what you normally do with
right.
is like, here's how you should feel right now.
Often, I mean, in this film, he actually more or less lets the cue play out.
Mm-hmm.
Every time he kind of brings it up, like you do get to kind of enjoy it and it plays out. In a lot of his films, he'll start up like a very beautiful piece of music and then just cut it hard. Like, right when you're kind of getting into it and it's like going nicely with the images and you're kind of getting lulled into this like sense of like immersion in the film.
Yeah.
And then he'll just hard cut it again with like a car horn or cut to a different scene or something. And it's just like, oh, it's like averted cinematic pleasure, you know?
He's like, are you enjoying this?
Yeah.
Stop it.
It's like, too bad. Yeah. That music cue, though, Scorsese used it in Casino.
Oh, really?
Which, again, is another film about – it comes up like several times in the film.
Oh, it sounds familiar.
But it also comes up in that scene where De Niro is driving out to the desert to meet Pesci, and there's like that. There's like these really wide screen shots of the desert, and the car is going across it, and that's when the Contempt theme is playing. But it's also he has like this like drum solo mixed in at the same time. It's really cool the way the two tracks are kind of like it's like a mashup, you know, and it works really well. But then there's other times in Casino when it's like. Just De Niro and Sharon Stone arguing about whatever that the Contempt theme will start to play.
Why is this called Contempt?
I think, well, it's
Is it contempt for one another? Is it that literal?
It could also be contempt for Hollywood filmmaking, you know?
Right.
Contempt for like the role of money in the world, that speech that Michelle Piccoli has where it's like, why does so much of what we do have to, you know, derive ultimately from money? Like, why can't we just be what we want to be, which is kind of the world of like Homer that they're kind of in a way sort of contrasting with.
And I love that Palance this whole time is I think he thinks that Piccoli is just a silly man.
Yeah.
Right. Clearly doesn't have any respect for him.
Yeah.
Or like his art or craft.
When Piccoli kind of makes that big speech at the end and he's expecting to have his moment of catharsis and everybody just kind of just shrugs it off.
Yeah.
You know, Fritz Lang literally kind of looks at him and just like shrugs his shoulders and he goes, well, one must suffer, you know?
Yeah, that's in most movies. That would be such a big moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was so great.
But, you know, then again, like when they do meet at the very end, when he's telling him goodbye and he's going to leave, he does say like, I hope we see each other again soon.
Yeah, so that was kind of a nice moment.
I think Lang, his attitude towards Piccoli is a little bit sort of like, maybe I recognize a little bit of myself when I was younger in you, that kind of feistiness.
Yeah.
And while I find it ultimately be a little juvenile. Like, I do get where that's coming from. And I know that later in life you'll mature and, you know, you'll maybe have like a little more balanced perspective on things.
Yeah, it's interesting how little there was a lot of talk about the writing, but there was so little of it.
Yeah.
There was that one scene with him at the typewriter.
Where he's writing like a play or something.
Yeah.
It's not even,
There's no scenes of him anguishing over writing this thing.
Right, right.
And you never see him writing this thing. And the whole time I was like, has he been writing this thing? Has he delivered a script?
Yeah.
Like, what's even the status of this thing?
Well, there's a point in the apartment where he mentions, like, there's a screening going on. He's like, we should go to the screening. Maybe it'll give me some ideas for this movie. And she says to him, like, you know, why don't you just get your own ideas? Why do you have to steal other people's?
That was a pretty sweet burn.
Yeah, it's a sweet burn, and it's a commentary Godard is making maybe even on himself because so much of his cinema is like responding to other filmmakers' work. Very little of it seems to like emerge from like a vacuum.
Yeah.
It's all like part of a larger conversation.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So she kisses Jack Palance, and the way he shoots that, you get the sense that she looks out and sees her husband looking in.
It's meant to be seen, really.
Yeah, but the way he frames it is even a little bit confusing.
Whether they can see each other or not.
Yeah, exactly. You're not totally for sure until it's confirmed, but he doesn't go down there and scream at her. And she doesn't even seem to be in love with Jack Palance or anything.
No, I think she's doing
it. She's bored.
Yeah, she's bored, and I feel like she's doing it more as a way to provoke him.
Yeah.
She's using Jack Palance to kind of get back at Michelle Piccoli rather than that she herself is. But at the same time, I think she does – what she likes about Jack Palance is that he is like the polar opposite of Paul, Michelle Piccoli.
He's beyond decisive.
He's so ego.
Yeah.
He's so ego-driven where he says, you know, I like gods. I know exactly how they feel, you know?
That line. He's
the complete exact opposite of the husband that he's just – pure decision, pure action in the world.
Right.
His
suit is always buttoned up.
Yeah.
His tie is always perfect, whereas her husband, his tie is, is always unbuttoned and like half pulled up.
He's like a cartoon of like the kind of 1950s, like, you know, white collar, like, worker bee kind of guy.
Yeah,
it's just kind of like straight shooter company
hats
guy.
On,
yeah, hats
tilted
on.
Back.
Exactly.
Chomping on a cigar.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, Michelle Piccoli is this kind of like neurotic, intellectual, full of self-doubt, you know, uncertain, like what he, like all that.
But the whole Capri sequence is interesting because not a lot goes on there either. Like you finally get them kissing. And so all this, like, is there anything really even going on? Is sort of confirmed.
Right.
And you do get, I feel like that is not only confirmation, like that's not their first kiss.
No.
It doesn't feel like.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
It feels like they've kind of there's been something before that. Yeah, probably.
Like, it's almost like there's this whole movie going on that you never get to see.
Right, right. Yeah.
Which can be frustrating.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he asked her when he gets to the, you know, the first house, mm-hmm. and he's been delayed in getting there, and like half an hour has gone by, and he asked her, you know, did anything happen while I was gone?
Right.
And she says, nothing special.
Yeah.
Which could mean nothing happened, but it could also be her cutting way of saying, like, it's nothing special for a man to hit on me.
Right.
That's just, that happens every day of my life, you know, nothing
totally
special.
Did.
I'm used to being hit on.
Uh-huh. There's so much left to the viewer to just sort of figure out or not.
Yeah, yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
But, you know, after that kiss is when, I mean, everything kind of goes downhill from there.
Right.
You think he's going to, you know, she brings him the gun and you think
it's totally
Here going in that direction.
It's funny. He mentions to her before that, just before that, he's like, I saw you kissing Prokosh. And she goes, I know.
Yeah.
And that's it. Like, there's
just
no
way.
Yeah. That's it.
Yeah. When she jumped in the water and was skinny dipping, I thought he was going to shoot her.
Yeah. I think you're meant to. I think you're meant, you know, the first time you see it, all throughout that whole sequence where he's having his big I quit speech.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, when they're walking outside and he even kind of grabs her and he says, you know, just tell me, like, what's wrong or I'll hurt you or something like
that.
Yeah.
And she doesn't feel threatened by him at all, though.
Although she, you know.
Even though he did hit her.
When he slaps her in the apartment, she says, you scare me, Paul, and it's not the first time.
Right, right.
Which is, I don't know, like that. Like the physical violence in the film is something that I think was meant to be taken more at face value in 1963.
Yeah, probably.
You know, it was more of like a movie convention.
Yeah.
It plays very differently, obviously, today, where it's like,
sure,
the first time that could be the end right there.
Oh,
you know?
Sure.
Yeah.
But he doesn't even seem, and it's weird to talk about like hitting your wife like this, but he doesn't even seem into it.
Like, no, it's just kind of like what you do or something.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah.
He doesn't even seem really angry or like abusive necessarily.
And I think this is another commentary Godard is maybe making on, like, again, like the hypocrisy of that character.
Yeah.
That he fancies himself like this intellectual, progressive, leftist, like in favor of working man and so on.
Yeah.
And yet he's a wife beater. He's, you know, he has sort of very retrograde views on like how a marriage should work, you know,
right.
That he's like the man, he should decide and so on. Although I guess he's deferring some of that by asking her to make the decision.
Right.
But yeah, I think ultimately he's just meant to be kind of this like slippery, like weak character, you know? And it's funny because he is in a way a stand-in for Godard. So he's almost criticizing himself in a way
mm-hmm.
for being this kind of like undecisive, unsure
mm-hmm.
Kind of person.
Right.
Yeah.
And then we get, you know, this gun is lingering out there. There's so much suspicion and nothing ever happens.
Yeah.
With a gun. It's like red herring isn't a strong enough.
Yeah. He falls asleep by the water. And then when she writes the letter to him, she says, like, I found your revolver. I took all the bullets out. And
right.
I'm out of here. Yeah.
And that is intercut with her leaving with Jack Palance in that sports car.
Supposedly just to get a ride back to the city.
Right.
Back to Rome or something.
Right.
She's going to be a typist.
And he kills them.
Yeah.
He pulls out and gets, like, hammered by an 18-wheeler.
Which is,
or a gas truck.
Yeah, which is that's something Godard does a ton in his 60s films again.
Just like an abrupt.
Yeah, just like not even really like.
Breathless ended like that, right?
Yes, yeah. Breathless ends like that. A lot of his films end like that.
Really?
Where, because I think for him, I feel like his characters most of the time are less three-dimensional real people
mm-hmm.
than they are almost like propositions, or they represent a certain position intellectually, or they're symbolic of something.
Right.
But they're a little bit more like pawn, you know, chess pieces that he can kind of move around.
Yeah.
And so like killing them off to him, I think it's just sort of, he doesn't want to write like a happily ever after, and he doesn't want to just like fade out on people doing some random action or whatever.
Does he not know how to end it, the movie?
Kind of. Well, although
lazy?
That comes from the novel too.
Really?
Them both dying like that.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Well,
although
it's
different. Apparently in the novel, they have like a fender bender or something, and somehow she snaps her neck and you know, dies.
Oh,
but
interesting.
The producer doesn't noticed this for a long time. So he's just driving down the road and she's dead next to him. He doesn't know it.
Oh, my God.
It's kind of ghastly.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so Godard does the, especially the use of them going under like an oil tanker that, you know. That's sort of his commentary, I think, on, again, it's like it's a highway. There's like an 18-wheeler.
Right.
It's sort of – it's modern life. Like mm-hmm. I think really – like I would say within the context of this film, you could read that ending as like if you think back to Homer, mm-hmm. if you think back to like classical tragedy and so on, death is meant to have so much more significance and mm-hmm. weight to it. And like the form of your death should almost be a reflection of like the form of your life.
Mm-hmm.
And it should sort of be almost like the zenith or the kind of the final outcome mm-hmm. of everything that's led to this moment.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in modernity, it could just be a random accident on the highway and it means
right.
nothing. And there's no greater like meaning or satisfaction or catharsis to be drawn from it.
Yeah.
It's just kind of like, yeah, he just got, you know, he made a mistake when he was driving and he pulled out. He peels out in like a very aggressive way, true to his character, you know?
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, some of that too, it's like he's been kind of undone by his own like aggressiveness or something. But yeah, I think it's just meant to be like disconcerting
mm-hmm.
and disconnected from the rest of the film in a way because it just happens, you know?
Yeah, it's also, I just now am realizing kind of the only interaction with the real world in the film.
Yeah.
They're in his villa. They're in his other villa.
Right.
They're on the studio lot.
Yeah.
I guess they're in that theater in the one scene. They're in the screening room. They're in the apartment. Like, no one's ever in a store.
Yeah.
No one's
ever
on the street. No one's ever interacting with any outside world except for this final time. And they get, you know, hammered by a truck.
Yeah. Well, he really empties all the exterior shots of, like, any other people unless it's, like, the crew or something.
Yeah.
But
I mean, there
aren't
any people
in this film. You never see people just, like, milling around, like –
like
about
you
town.
Get rid of the theater scene and there's like six people in this movie.
Which
I guess the film crew, but
yeah. But he's definitely like that I think gives the film a certain feeling of abstraction.
Yeah.
A certain
sure.
feeling of unreality and a certain feeling of like we're kind of looking at the real world, but we're looking at it from this kind of askew sort of angle.
Hal Hartley.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So interesting.
Yeah.
I'm glad to know that I was on base with that comparison.
Oh, for sure.
Because as I was watching it, I was like, I feel a lot
this
of
Hal
Hartley going on.
Absolutely.
I love that they're pals.
Yeah. One more thing. We've gone way past the scene, but the scene in the screening room
mm-hmm.
when Michel Piccoli has a comment to the effect, something about culture.
Mm-hmm.
And Prokosh's response to him is, when I hear the word culture, that's when I get about my checkbook.
Right.
And that is a tweak of a Goebbels quote.
Oh, wow.
When I hear the word culture, that's when I reach for my revolver.
Wow.
And so Godard is equating the two things.
Yeah,
he's
producer
saying,
with a Nazi.
Yeah. And capitalism with like fascism.
Yeah.
Because he's essentially saying that under fascism, it's like physical might that, you know, that's where power mm-hmm. exists and the ability to basically kill your opponents outright. And, you know, Godard is saying under the capitalist system, that's how you buy people and make them do what you want them to do.
Right.
And it's like Michel Piccoli doesn't want to do this film, but he's probably going to do it
mm-hmm.
because, you know, as Jack Palance says, I heard you have a very beautiful wife.
Right.
You know? It's like you're not free to make your own decisions.
Yeah.
It's like there are these external pressures that are acting on you. And it's just interesting that he also has that parallel with like the Nazi and
uh-huh.
the producer and so on, because Fritz Lang was offered oversight of the entire German film industry.
Oh, really?
By Goebbels.
Wow.
He called him to his office and he said, you know, basically like, I want you to run the whole film industry in Germany.
Uh-huh.
And Fritz Lang like left the country that night and was just like, I got to get out of here.
Wow.
And he, you know, he eventually made his way to the United States and
holy cow.
Had a whole second career in Hollywood.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
So, quite an experience watching this movie. It was not what I thought it was going to be. It was, confounding in a lot of ways.
Sure.
And like, it is staying with me.
Yeah.
And like, it's a movie I want to see again, but they're tough nuts to crack, you know?
Absolutely.
Because
yeah.
you don't sit there and think like, oh man, I'm really loving this.
Yeah.
It's provocative and heady, and it really, really, you got to put your thinking cap on to watch these films.
It's a very different way of engaging with a movie.
Totally.
It's completely counterintuitive to what we're used to. Just
right.
like the kind of pleasure of becoming absorbed in like a story.
Yeah,
and
the
characters.
And the three-act structure and the, everything we know about film and are used to, which kind of makes me wonder, is that like just because we're used to it, that is the thing?
We're conditioned to like think of it that way?
Yeah,
sure.
Or was that the superior story?
Yeah.
You know,
like
those
the
seven
best,
stories
the best way for it to go.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, it's interesting. I think Godard is just somebody that is interested in pushing the medium forward.
Sure.
It's really inspirational to me that the films that he's making today, mm-hmm. he made a film in 3D called Goodbye to Language that is like the most experimental thing anybody's made in like mm-hmm. a long time in that medium of 3D especially.
Right.
To do a 3D film where, for instance, at one point, you know, like when they make a 3D film, you have two cameras mm-hmm. side by side. Each of them is kind of imitating the left eye or the right eye of
right.
the viewer. And in Goodbye to Language, he has a moment where one of the two cameras pans and the other stays in place. So as you're watching it, your brain is actually receiving these two different images.
Wow.
And the, you know, at first they're together and then they diverge.
Uh-huh.
And it's sort of like you can close one eye and see one picture, close the other eye, see the other picture.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like gives you a headache and it's like uh-huh. your brain almost like rejects what's going on.
And he's doing this in his 80s.
Yeah, yeah. And
wow.
then it, the camera pans back and then the image becomes like the
whole.
Same image again.
Uh-huh.
And I love stuff like that. I mean, I love that he is still, he's more radical now in his 80s than
yeah.
he was even, you know, when he was a younger person in like his 30s making
That's great.
His first films.
So cool.
Yeah.
What's up next? Do you know?
I don't know, actually. This is the first time that like my queue of stuff that I had kind
All right.
of in my head.
Well, let's think about it.
Yeah.
Here's what I think maybe we should do is and maybe not just a straight up alternate,
mm-hmm.
but do films like this that are a little headier and tougher.
Sure.
And perhaps foreign.
Sure.
And then mix those in with some stuff that's a bit more accessible.
Sure, sure.
But maybe I would love to keep
underrated,
doing,
underseen.
Yeah, I would love to keep doing stuff like this, though, because I think like a large portion of American audiences haven't seen Godard still.
Yeah, yeah. It's cool to broaden the horizons. And
yeah, I encourage everyone to see this movie.
Yeah.
It looks – the one I got looked really good.
There's a few shots that
whatever.
Are kind of beat up where it's like they had to use an older print for certain scenes or
uh-huh.
something. But
looked
so
pretty
I hope
good on my TV.
It looked good. There's maybe what you saw is even a different transfer than what's on the Blu-ray. There's a few shots that are like kind of crunchy looking.
Yeah.
But yeah, overall, very, very beautiful looking film.
All right. Well, we'll figure it out, everybody. But thanks again to Casey.
Thank you, sir.
And go watch Contempt.
Yeah.
What's the French title?
Le Mépris.
Le Mépris?
Le Mépris. And yeah, 1963, Godard.
Awesome.
There's a Criterion DVD that's long, long time out of print, had some great extras on it.
Yeah.
There's a Blu-ray that's out now that's non-Criterion, and I hope the film will eventually, you know, return to the Criterion stable. They'll be able to put out a new
right.
version of it. But
awesome.
For now, yeah, you can. I think you can also stream it. That's what you did, right?
Yeah. Yeah. iTunes.
Yep.
Look good.
Yeah. Find it. Check it out.
All right. Thanks, everyone, and thank you, my friend.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.